You know what's a lot more fun than thinking about how to best pay off student loans? Thinking about how rich you're going to be one day in spite of your student loans. That's why we started the Financially Free Era podcast. Financially Free Era, if you search that term on any podcast platform, you're going to find it. It's hosted by my colleague Megan McGuire over at SLP Wealth. And this podcast is where we dive deep into all the things you want to know about how to be wealthy one day. How do you best maximize tax loopholes and write-offs? How do you best invest money? How do you make smart money moves in spite of even a very large six-figure student loan balance that are going to get you where you want to be much sooner? Go follow the Financially Free Era podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. I promise you, if you like Student Loan Planners podcast, you will love Financially Free Era by SLP Wealth. Search that term, follow the show, you will love it.
What's up, everybody? It's Megan here, and I'm on the Student Loan Planner podcast today. I'm taking over for Travis while he's out for the holiday. I'm usually over there at the SLP Wealth version of our podcast called Financially Free Era. Make sure to go check that out on anywhere you're listening to this podcast. But today I wanted to chat about filing taxes separately, what student loan borrowers need to recheck or just get prepared to start looking at as tax time approaches. I don't think it's too early to start talking about this because there are things that filing separately, there's just a lot of proactive things you could do and mistakes we want to make sure we're not making. And if we are making them, we go and correct those as soon as possible. I want to talk about filing separately in particular today because a lot of our listeners utilize this strategy to keep the student loan payment as low as possible. There are big pros to doing this, very big positives. It keeps the payment a lot lower than because it's based off of just the borrower's income. But it also comes with some negatives or some cons. So I want to make sure that we're just having a refresh conversation of that this year and you know what to look for or prepare for as we come into the tax season that is upon us. Let's jump in. Married filing separately. This is if you are married, you and your spouse are filing a married return. You have the decision to either file jointly or separately. Married filing separately is pretty darn appealing because it can lower your income-driven repayment payments themselves because it keeps the payment off of just your own income. Or if you're in a community property state, which we'll talk about that towards the end, community property states split income between the two spouses. So it's kind of an interesting calculation because if you, let's say you're the breadwinner, you make $300,000 a year, your spouse stays home, you file taxes married separately. Logically, in your mind, you would think, well, what's the point of filing separately? My income is $300. That's what I'm going to be reporting on my tax return. In a community property state, that is wrong. In a community property state, what they do is they take your income between you and your spouse and they divide it in half between the two tax returns that you're filing if we're doing married separate. So that $300,000 earner is going to look like they make $150,000 on paper. And that is a huge benefit to filing separately if we're looking at going towards loan forgiveness on our income-driven plan. So we'll talk a lot more about community property state towards the end because I know that's not applicable to everyone. Community property states, just so you know, like what section of this conversation to pay attention to, there are 9 community property states. If you live in Arizona, California, Idaho, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Washington, or Wisconsin, these are the states you're able to file with this community property state split, or technically you're supposed to file with this community property split. So if that's you, some of these things we're about to talk about may still be relevant, but definitely hang out for the last part of this conversation because community property state stuff is very different than common law state income splitting. All right, so who else is this episode really for? It's for folks who are married or who are planning on getting married in the future and they're wanting to get an idea of what this will look like when it comes to affecting your student loan plan. Getting married, your student loans should not be a reason to not get married. That might be silly to say, but I have literally had folks hop on a call with me and say, "We have been delaying marriage because of these student loans because we don't know what's going to happen." Don't do that. Just make sure you have a good game plan together. Don't let the loans dictate a lot of your life choices here. So if you are married, getting married soon, this could be super helpful. If you are someone going towards loan forgiveness, whether that be public service loan forgiveness or the longer term forgiveness on one of the income driven plans, this could be super helpful. Folks who have high income households or uneven household incomes, to understand how like the mechanics of married filing separately work and how that flows through to your payment. And anyone who was surprised by their tax bill this past year by filing separately, maybe hang around because I'm going to talk through some reasons why that might be the case. Primary reason why we want to file separately when it comes to a student loan plan is to exclude spouse's income or to reduce your income for your income-driven repayment calculations. Let's say one spouse has pretty large student loans in the mix, other spouse does not. We have gone into this marriage understanding that the loans are the borrowers, and or we're just really trying to maximize that loan forgiveness, keeping the payment as low as possible. Because if we file jointly, you and your spouse file jointly, and they don't have student loans, your payment is going to be based off of joint income no matter what. No matter if you file alternative documentation, they are going to ask for your spouse's income if you file a joint tax return. So that's why you may hear us talk about like the most recent tax return being pretty darn important when it comes to your student loan plan. And they're going to look at the most recent tax return always when it comes to your income-driven repayment in one capacity or another. One capacity would be literally just looking back at that last tax return on the income, like the adjusted gross income. They pull that straight through from your adjusted gross income number on your tax return. That's line 11 on the 1040. And what they're also looking for is how you filed. Did you file single? Did you file jointly? Did you file separately? Because that factors into your household size as well. Let's say, you know, you're going to update your payment. You're going to switch payments right now. It's December, about to be January 2026. The most recent tax return on file for almost everybody at this point should be 2024. So if you're making changes to your plan now, what does that 2024 return say? If it has you filing jointly, even if you're wanting to file separately, you are not going to be able to exclude your spouse's income until the most recent return is filing separately. That's sometimes a misconception. Sometimes folks feel like, oh, well, I could just submit like my own pay stub and not include my spouse's. No, you technically cannot do that. There is a question on the application that asks if you have access to your spouse's information. If you are married, you want to answer that question ethically. If you know what your spouse's income is, you generally do things together, you pay for things together, you've got a checking account that you're on together, you have access to each other's income information. That question is primarily for people who are separated, who are going through a divorce, who are technically married but are not in communication about their money anymore, right? It's also for abuse situations, like making sure that there is a way to exclude spousal income in those really horrible situations. So we have to be honest there. And if we're married, we do things together, we live in the same household, you got to say that you have access to your spouse's income. And when you do that, it's going to go off of that last tax return, if it was joint or separate, whatever you did. All right. So with all of that said, with some of those mechanics talked about on the application, a lot of folks may be considering filing 2025 taxes married separately, either again or for the first time. And there are some big trade-offs that we want to talk about. We don't want to forget exist. So one trade-off with common law states is, and that's any state that's not a community property state that I mentioned earlier, is that married filing separate tax brackets, when you're looking at the tax brackets themselves, are less favorable, or they can be, depending on what you and your spouse's income is. You could hit certain phase outs faster, which this basically just results in a higher marginal tax rate potentially and less flexibility for certain deductions. And the takeaway here is how I kind of boil it down to something pretty simple is if you and your spouse live in a common law state, not community property, and you make pretty vastly different incomes. So let's say you make $200,000 and your spouse makes $70,000 a year. That's a pretty big difference in your income. So there is going to be a pretty big difference in the difference between filing jointly and filing separately because of how much extra tax the higher income earning spouse is going to pay, unfortunately. Now, sometimes it could still make a lot of sense to file separately. So in that example, let's say again, $200,000, your spouse is making $70,000. Let's say we have no dependents and we're just W-2 earners. We don't have a business. Let's say no dependents, so no daycare. We're not on Medicare. We don't own a small business. The tax cost, the estimate there is almost about $1,000 more. And being in a higher tax bracket for the higher income earning spouse and having to pay an additional Medicare tax. So the extra tax cost to filing separately, let's round up to about $1,600 to $1,700. That is the cost of filing separately in this case. Now, that's not where the story stops. So that's one important thing to understand is how much is it going to cost me to file separately compared to filing jointly? In this scenario, it's about $1,700 for the year. Next thing we need to ask is, okay, well, what is my separate payment calculation off of just my own income versus my joint payment? You know, what is that difference? So in this example, let's just keep things pretty darn simple. No dependents again. Let's look at married separate, $200,000. Let's say that's the spouse who has the student loans, right? So the student loan payment, if we were filing separately on $200,000, if we were new IBR eligible, would be $1,400 a month. If we were filing jointly, including that $70,000 into the whole picture, the joint payment would be about I'm going to round up to $2,000 a month on new IBR. If we filed taxes married separately, excluding our spouse's income that makes about $70,000 a year, that payment drops down to $1,400 a month. So now we've got our difference monthly in what the joint payment's going to be to the separate payment, and it's about $600 a month. So that's the $2,000 with the payment being joint off of $270,000 of total income compared to filing separately where it's just off of the $200,000 of income. That payment is $1,400 a month. So the difference there is $600 between $2,000 and $1,400. And that's the monthly savings to filing separately. So $600 times 12, because when we lock in a student loan payment, it's locking it in usually for 12 months. 600 times 12 is $7,200. That's how much we save over the course of the year using a separate return versus filing jointly. Now, going back to what did the tax cost us? Well, it was going to cost us approximately $1,700 to file separately. That's the extra tax that we would be paying. So I take the savings in the student loan payments, which is $7,200, minus the $1,700 or so of what the tax cost would be. So that's $7,200 minus $1,700. That's $5,500 of still savings in our pocket over the course of the year because our payments are so much less. So in this case, in this situation, I'm still saying, hey, yeah, it does cost us $1,700 to file separately from a tax perspective, but the benefits of our lower payment over the course of the year far outweigh what the tax cost is because we're saving $5,500 at the end of the day, taking into account the tax cost and then the student loan payment savings. That's the analysis that you want to be doing each year is you want to be taking a look at both at what the difference is in your tax total tax cost for the year to filing separately compared to filing jointly, and compare that to what we would save over the course of the year with a joint payment and a separate payment. You just have to find that crossover point to where we're definitely saving more money when we're looking at both things together, or we're not. And if we're not saving money, then that's when maybe filing jointly continues to make sense just to keep doing, even though the payment would be higher because we're just not saving enough to warrant the cost. That was factoring in a pretty simple case with maybe a higher overall tax cost. There are other reduced lost or reduced credits that you want to take into account as well when you're taking a look at the total tax cost for the year. So one thing that is not allowed or a couple things that you may lose access to being able to deduct would be the dependent care credit if we're filing separately. That could be a pretty big impact for families that pay a lot for daycare or preschool or after school care. So that's something that you want to factor into the overall tax cost when you're calculating this. There's also the student loan interest deduction, which this is a little less impactful to most people. It's basically mostly disallowed when you file separately. There's a $2,500 deduction that just is gone if we are above certain income thresholds. But you're, as a higher income earner, you're probably already not able to take this deduction. So that's maybe something to just know is like, even if you file jointly, you might make too much money to take that deduction anyways. The limit this year for 2025, if you're filing jointly, you're not able to take this deduction if you make more than $200,000 together as a couple of modified adjusted gross income. It starts to phase itself out between $170,000 and $200,000. But if you're making more than that, filing jointly with you and your spouse, then you're not going to be able to take this deduction anyways. So it's not too big of a deal to miss out on this. It's also a pretty low amount that we're missing out on. I think at the end of the day, it shakes out to like $400 or $500 of tax savings. So the student loan interest deduction is not something to be too worried about if we're losing it by filing separately. There's some other things that we might miss out on or just not be aware of. Others could be like education credits, the lifetime learning credit. The capital loss deduction might be limited if you're taking that. There are things that you have to consider when it comes to filing separately where if you are planning on itemizing, your spouse is going to have to itemize if we're filing separately. Y'all have to do the same thing. You can't take the standard deduction and your spouse itemizes. Y'all both have to do the same thing. So that's something that is sometimes kind of a hard truth to learn in the middle of tax season. And then one other thing I want to mention is if we're filing separately, we're not able to contribute directly to a Roth IRA because the income threshold to contribute directly to a Roth IRA, if we're filing separately, is very low. It's like $10,000, which most folks are making a lot more than that. So most folks who are filing separately are not able to contribute directly to a Roth IRA. That's where that backdoor Roth comes into play. And we've talked about that a few times on our podcast. We talk about that on the Financially Free Era podcast. But a backdoor Roth is a way to get around the limitation there on income to make sure that we can contribute. Sometimes people don't realize though. So like, for example, in 2025, let's say you didn't realize you were going to be filing separately, but you made Roth IRA contributions because your income was low enough to be able to make direct contributions this year. You decide, oh, I am going to file 2025 separately. Oops, you already made Roth IRA contributions. So you have to now go back and correct that. You have to amend those contributions. And that's a whole other podcast episode. We do have a podcast episode on that on the Financially Free Era pod. So go check that out. We'll probably do another one this upcoming year. That's just another can of worms that we have to fix before we close out the tax year, because technically we're not able to contribute directly. So we'd have to go back and fix that to make sure we're not getting in trouble with the IRS. So those are some things that we have to just watch out for and keep in mind when we're looking at filing separately. And I'm talking about all the downsides, but again, there are a lot of positives to filing separately. Just like that first example we walked through the numbers on, like it can save us a lot of money. And that's why filing separately is such a big part of the planning conversation. And it's something that we do need to check on an annual basis, I would say, to make sure that we're doing the right things, because your income changes year to year. Your family situation may change year to year. And you just want to make sure that you're pulse checking this over time. The right filing status is really the one that minimizes your total cost, including loans, including taxes, and including any missed opportunities. So what's the total comprehensive look at this, looking at all things included? So what should you do every tax season? I do think you should have a checklist that you're kind of going down the line and taking a look at. You want to run both married filing joint and married filing separate tax projections. And you want to, at the same time, pretty much recalculate what a student loan payment would be off of that separate income and off of that joint income. So you know the difference between what the student loan payment would be between joint and separate, and what you know the difference would be between filing joint and separately. Then you can compare. And you may want to revisit this, especially if income has changed, if kids have entered the picture, daycare costs have increased, or maybe your forgiveness timeline has shifted. So these are some triggers that you'd want to maybe revisit this. But I do think on an annual basis, it can make sense to take a look at this. Common mistakes that I see as a planner when it comes to talking through married separately, when it comes to your student loan plan, you know, folks saying, well, I've always filed jointly. Why would I consider filing separately? Well, we talked about all the reasons why you might file separately. It's not like a moral issue. Like, you're not doing anything wrong. You can totally decide to file separately and you can flip-flop from year to year. You don't have to do the same thing every year. The IRS doesn't care. At the end of the day, it's just what makes most sense for you to do now, this year. And your student loans could be the reason why filing separately makes sense. And if you're working with a CPA, a common mistake I see is just not explaining to the CPA or the tax preparer why we're looking at filing separately, because you'll probably get some eyebrows raised at you like, wait, why? Why do you want to file separate? Because most married couples file jointly. That is the most efficient. That's usually where we find the most tax savings. Usually, not always, but usually. A lot of CPAs and tax preparers are not filing a lot of separate returns unless they have folks who have very large student loan balances that they're going towards loan forgiveness on. And they're not going to be super familiar with the student loan piece of this puzzle because their specialty is tax. That's usually the lane they stay within. They're not going to know much about student loans and the impact of their tax return filings for you on the student loan return or on the student loan repayment, I mean. So explain to the CPA why you're filing separately. It's for student loan purposes. You can go ahead and give them like that crossover point that you're calculating with the student loan payment to say, hey, if filing separately costs me less than this amount, we want to go ahead and file separate because it's going to save us a lot more in our student loan payments to do so. Then they start to get it. Like they would logically understand, oh, okay, that it has an impact on that other piece of your financial puzzle. And if you need help navigating this, like this is literally what we do in our student loan consultations. You sign up for a student loan consult. It's a 1-hour conversation with one of our consultants on the team. We're, of course, going through like what repayment plan should you be on? What does that look like over time? But we're also talking pretty heavily about how we should be considering filing taxes because it has such a big impact on the payment. So we can give you a lot of good nuggets to take to your CPA or your tax preparer to make sure that everybody's on the same page and you have an idea of what to do. Other mistakes that I see is just, you know, looking at only the monthly payment, not like the whole picture. So if it's going to cost us way more in taxes to file separately, we might want to reconsider or just talk about other options, maybe amending tax returns in the future to recoup some of that lost tax hit. And then another just big overall mistake is not coordinating our tax strategy with our student loan strategy. There is so much crossover here for folks, especially who are on income-driven repayment plans going towards loan forgiveness. So we have to be coordinating the two. So a couple things I want to mention about community property states. I identified who is in a community property state at the beginning of this episode. There's 9 states. And if you've worked and lived in a community property state, this is how you are supposed to be filing. But basically, if you decide to file separately, it's not like a common law state where your income is on your tax return and the spouse's income is on their tax return. They look at your income as a whole. So total income. Let's use that same example we started with at the beginning of this conversation. Let's say you're making $200,000, your spouse is making $70,000. If you file separately, your tax return is not going to show $200,000. It's going to show $270 divided by 2, which is $135,000. So that's $135,000 on your tax return, $135,000 on your spouse's tax return, because it's both of those numbers divided by 2. This is done with the 8958 form. It's a tax form that's submitted that helps you split the income between the two returns. Now, what does that do to your student loan payment? Well, of course, if we're filing jointly in a community property state, our payment's still going to be based off of that joint income, so the $2,000. But if we file separately and we're splitting the income in that way between the two tax returns, your payment drops from the last example, if it was off of $200,000 of income, remember, the payment was $1,400. If we file separately with $135 showing up on your tax return, your payment's not $1,400, it's $860 a month. So this is why community property states, I get pretty excited because there's a lot of opportunity for our breadwinners out there to really reduce your student loan payment, because on paper, by how your state splits income, it looks like you make so much less than you actually do. So that can save from $1,400 down to $860. That's a big swing. That's another $540 of savings by being in a community property state versus living in a common law state. So that has a big impact on your forgiveness overall, number crunching, because we're paying less towards the loans and getting more forgiven, which is a win-win. Some folks might think, oh my gosh, I'm not the breadwinner though, but I have the student loans. I live in a community property state. This is going to hurt me. Pause. It's not actually, which is really cool. What's great about being in a community property state is it can only really benefit you. This spouse that we just talked through was the breadwinner. They would just use their tax return to verify their student loan payment here coming up. They link back to the most recent tax return. It pulls through that split income. Perfect. But let's say you are not the breadwinner. You're the spouse that makes less than the other spouse in the equation, but you're the one who has the student loans. You might think, oh my gosh, that's going to make my income look a lot higher than it actually is, because my spouse makes my income on this split return look higher. So what you could do is you can honestly and ethically link back to your separate tax return when you're updating your income, because it's going to show that we filed separately. Perfect. They can't use your spouse's income if we filed separately, remember? Next question it's going to ask you on the application is your income lower than what's reflected on your tax return? You can honestly answer that question as yes, because your income that's going to show on your pay stub, for example, or your own W-2 is going to show just your own income. And if you are not the breadwinner in the household, your income is going to show as lower. And so you can say yes to that question. My income is lower than what's reflecting on my tax return. And you can use that alternative documentation of income to calculate your payment. So in this example, let's say the $70,000 income person, spouse in the mix, was the student loan borrower. We're filing separately in a community property state. Technically, on the tax return, it's going to show $135,000, but we're going to say, hey, that's not actually my income. Then you can submit your W-2 or a pay stub, and the payment then drops down to $320 on new IBR if we're just having it go off of the $70,000 of income. If you're the borrower, you're the one with the student loans, and we're filing separately. Works out pretty nicely in community property states, which is great. So it doesn't hurt us if we're not the breadwinner. It definitely helps us if we are the breadwinner, and it helps us if we're not the breadwinner too. And the other really positive thing is one of the first things I mentioned at the beginning with common law states on why the tax cost might be more expensive is the higher income earning spouse is in a higher tax bracket than they otherwise would be if they were filing jointly. That contributes to a common law married filing separate tax situation, making the tax cost a little higher. What's great in community property states is you are in the same tax bracket as you would be, generally speaking, but you are generally in the same tax bracket as you would be if you were filing jointly as you are filing separately, because the income is split. If you're looking at the tax brackets and you're comparing the joint tax return to the separate tax returns and what tax brackets they're falling in based on that income threshold, it's the same. So there's very little tax implication for filing separately in a community property state when it comes to the actual tax bracket cost, which is pretty nice. You'll still miss out on certain deductions and credits like the dependent care stuff we talked about, the student loan interest deduction. But those are not as costly as sometimes the tax cost itself, like that tax bracket cost. So those are some thoughts on community property estates. If you are confused about any of this, or you want to make sure that you're maximizing your situation to the best of its ability, you're getting all of your ducks in a row ready for tax season, then that is literally what we do in our one-on-one consultations. So make sure to schedule a consult if you haven't, or a refresh if you need to update your plan because it's been a while. 2025 taxes are going to be coming up. This is kind of an early reminder of what to be thinking about, looking for, so you're not scrambling the closer we get to April, because that's when tax professionals are super busy. They're not going to, you know, be super happy to slow down and run a bunch of scenarios for you if it's April 14th. They're just not. They're going to be putting you on some kind of extension. So have an idea of what you want to do, the pros and cons of filing separately compared to filing jointly. Have kind of an idea of what that's supposed to look like, and then you can start to execute on that sooner rather than later this tax season. Don't wait until the last minute, okay? Don't. It's not fun for anybody involved. You don't want to have to make rushed decisions or feel rushed in making a decision on how you need to file. That is all I've got for you today. Hopefully that is helpful to think about. I know taxes aren't a fun conversation, but a good kind of appetizer for what to really jump into when it comes time to actually take a look at everything as 2025 wraps up. Thanks for having me and letting me crash this podcast. And definitely check out Financially Free Era on wherever you're listening to this podcast. That's where we dive into a lot more like wealth building things. So student loan flavor, but we're talking more about wealth, wealth topics, financial planning topics, financial behavior, things like that, things I'm super interested in. And I'll catch you over there if you find yourself wandering over there. Hope you have a wonderful holiday season and have a great rest of your year.
Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.